Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Hey, man, we got a little special Saturday edition for you. A freebie. That's right. Take a knee. And you can listen to Aubrey Marcus. He's from On It. He's the brains behind On It. And we did quite a stimulating conversation with the lad. You can go to podcastone.com/premium to subscribe and get the whole catalog if you like. That's a couple bucks a month and you get some world-class advice and world-class guests. And also tonight, Saturday night, you can check out my Facebook page. Both before and after the fight, we'll be watching it. I think Cousin Sal will be there. We got Hench, Sheck, you know, a lot of the usual suspects, and we'll be breaking down the fight before and afterwards. So check us out, see what we're doing. And without any further ado, let's enjoy Aubrey Marcus.
This is Carolla Digital. Socrates, Buddha, Lombardi, great teachers, mentors, and coaches throughout history. Joined now by Adam Carolla.
Don't do your best, do my best.
Time to be motivated, inspired, and get wise. It's time to take a knee.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but get on. Mandate, get on. And welcome to yet another Take a Knee. It's our inspirational podcast. We try to motivate here. We have luminaries from all walks of life. Today, we're going with the supplement luminary. Aubrey Marcus, you know, from On It, everybody. Good to see you, Aubrey.
Yeah, again. Good to be back.
I take the supplements. I love the jump rope. I'm not sure if that's discontinued or not. There's always a little controversy about the jump rope.
We got some new ones. We got some speed ropes. We'll send you out.
I'm excited. It works. I take the there's the sleep enhancer, the spray. I'm trying to
think the melatonin spray.
Love that stuff.
Yeah,
on a
fast.
on a nightly basis. But let's talk about you. Let's talk about how you got to On It.
Mm-hmm.
And what your path was.
Yeah.
And where'd you grow up?
I grew up out here, Southern California, out in the valley.
In the valley?
Yeah, Camarillo.
Oh.
Yeah. It's what is that?
It's,
I don't
know, so deep in the valley, it's out of the valley.
All right.
It's like it's past the valley, but it's good.
Yeah.
Camarillo's good. Yeah, I grew up in North Hollywood, so like middle sort of end of the valley. But so you grew up in Camarillo.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, they got an outlet mall.
I don't think they did when I was there. We just had some horses, and it was cool, though.
So good, normal, quote-unquote, upbringing.
Yep.
And then what?
Yeah, then I went to, played basketball in high school, mm-hmm. you know, got some good recognition, some All-State honors, some different things in high school, and that was really my focus. I mean, that was everything at that point.
It was
Texas,
basketball.
And I was back, I was in Texas by then, so in Texas, high school sports are the shit. Like, that is what everybody is focused on. That's what the whole town rallies behind. And so everything was motivated towards being good at basketball.
It is interesting, like, growing up out here, Southern California, North Hollywood, no one gave a shit about sports in high school. Like, they just literally didn't give a shit. And Texas is so huge. What is the difference?
We had 3,000 people at our basketball games, 10,000 people at our football games. It was insane. I mean, it was a whole different environment. And I'm super grateful for having gone through that, because it was like I got to play like a little mini pro tour when I was 16, 17, and 18 years old.
So basketball was the thrust. You were very good at basketball. Otherwise, you wouldn't have made All-State. And mm-hmm. the plan was then what?
Yeah. At that point, though, you know, I realized there was a ceiling, you know, from genetics and just me not having the passion to try and grind it out and maybe wind up as the, you know, second string shooting guard for the Lithuania team in some league. You know, that was like my destination if I decided to pursue it. So just really went kind of headlong into philosophy, which was what I was really passionate about at the time, just the game of ideas, trying to solve problems. And that's what I graduated University of Richmond with a degree in, and it's been kind of like a guiding light ever since, you know, solving the problems.
I have this theory that people love sports because they're pure, in that every facet of life, it's always like, well, look at that guy. He's a rich guy. Yeah, you know, but that's daddy's money or nepotism. It's who you know. We have a lot of adages that I don't like, by the way. It's like who you know and all that kind of stuff and, you know, silver spoons and all that sort of stuff. But sports is just doesn't matter if your dad owns the team. Your dad can own the New York Giants. You don't get to play cornerback for the New York Giants. You don't get on the field. You don't get on the team. You don't get near the field. You get to, you know, they'll give you some title, but you don't get to play.
Yeah, you still got to make the shots, make the passes, make the catches. It's on you at
my,
that point.
My theory is that we're so intrinsically attracted to sports, all sports, because we never question that whoever's out there is the best in the world. And in almost every other endeavor, we sit around and go, ah, come on, I'm better than that guy, or I could do that, or I'd do a better job. Like, all the people that would watch Saturday Night Live would go, it sucked this week. I could do a better job writing sketches. Like, the guy worked at on a conveyor belt that made donuts, and he'd be like, I could do... No, you couldn't, but you'll never know it. But when you watch LeBron James play, you don't go, oh, come on. I'd school that dude. Like, right. You can't, and you can't do it in football.
Yeah.
And you can't, you don't see Cam Newton drop back in the pocket and go, oh, please, I'd tear that guy's head off. Like, you can't. So it's totally pure.
It's a meritocracy.
It's the purest of all the meritocracies. And right now, it's like we have a president, and the president's not going to work. Like, we're like, come on, that guy's dad, lent him $1 million to do, come on, that guy, right?
Right.
Sports, pure, 100% pure. And the other thing I like about sports is it forces you to quit and to move on and to abandon whatever dreams you may have had about it. Whereas you see people knocking around in acting, in comedy, in music, in business, and they're getting into their 50s and they're talking to you. Like, we all know the guy who is in his like 40s and he's telling you seriously about his plan of there's a guy and he's going on a European tour and he wants me to open for him. And it's like, you're thinking, you haven't done anything in 20 years. Like, this is never going to happen. It's never going to happen. But music, comedy, acting, whatever, art, it doesn't really kick you out.
Yeah. There's not that acute competition force, that thing, that person that you go up against and you go, oh, he's better than me. He'll always be better than me. Maybe I should look at something else. Like, there's always different angles and different ways and a million different options that you can take. But I see exactly what you mean. Cause there was that point where I was playing basketball and I was like, I will never do what any of these guys can do on the court right now.
Right.
So I'm out.
But
so I do something else.
But what I'm trying to say to people, cause we always do this. Hey, you got to follow those dreams and you got to hang on to them. You got to shoot for the stars. You got to hang on to those dreams. Like, I'm saying, no, you don't. Abandon those things. Just like you did in basketball. Just like I did, believe it or not, in football. Just like so many other, just like my son will do one day. He will abandon his dreams. He thinks he wants to play basketball. Basketball will not let him play. And he will abandon it. He might be good through high school like you were. He might take it to another level. But at some point, he's going to get cut off. And what would be sadder than to see my son, who's 11 now, at age 41, with a basketball in his hands going, I still think I could make the Clippers.
The beauty of it is that what you're really practicing is you're practicing being great at something. Like, that's what basketball gave me, is like the ability to know that I could be really good at something if I dedicated myself, if I sweat more, if I bled more, if I pushed harder, I could show improvement, I could get better. And that's the same thing that you apply, you know, to everything else. It's like what the swordsman Miyamoto Musashi said. Like, as soon as you learn how to do that in one thing, you can do that in anything.
I know. This is why when you must feel this having a company with a bunch of employees. You can almost tell immediately, like, the guys who wrestled in high school versus the ones who are in the chess club or something, because there's just a little more grit, a little more determination, a little
I'll
more
I'll take
whatever.
Chess club too, honestly. Like, anything that puts you under stress and forces you to respond under stress, when there's pressure, when there's that time clock and you're hitting it and you got some rushing across from you. Like, I'll
For
take
example.
That. I'll take that. But the people who've never exposed themselves to stress, as soon as there's stress, you watch them crumble. You know, and like, where'd you go, man? What happened to you? Like, where is that grit? Where is that, I'm going to plant my heels and stand? Where's that Spartan ethos, you know, that we all need to have to some degree to make it through these challenging situations?
I think it's the most important quality anyone can have. If you were to ask me if I could, like, wish one quality for my son and my daughter, it would be that quality. I would be, I think, smarts or brains or looks or agility or whatever it is would be a distant second to that sort of just determination, grit. I don't know that there's, you know, as I've been traveling through this world in this country in this time, I really don't believe there's not a lot you could do with that grit. I mean, or couldn't do with mm-hmm. that grit, meaning you want to start a supplement company or you want to start a podcast. I just feel like you can do what you want in this country in this time with that.
Totally. You got to be able to handle failure. You got to be able to handle success. You know, I've seen so many people crumble on the other side. You know, as soon as they start winning, they start to self-destruct because maybe they don't feel like they deserve it or they don't feel like, you know, they can handle the pressure if the stakes get higher. You know, all of these different things you can start to pattern in sports, and, you know, practice ultimately makes the master. The more you practice your response to stress, the more you practice your response to success, the better you'll be at it. And that's generally what, you know, causes you to be more successful, is how much you've practiced that along the way.
I know you do a little plant-based tourism,
yeah,
as it's called.
Put it lightly.
Ayahuasca. And I know you talk about the conquering the fear.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge proponent of conquering the fear. And I don't do the plant-based therapy or vacations. But I do lots of stuff that people think is dangerous or a little nutty or a little whatever. And the key is just agree to it down the road about 4 months and you'll have to show up.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's really like literally like somebody saying it's, you know, we're in June. Would you like to have a fist fight in November? And you just go, okay. And then you go about your day. And then at some point, somebody goes, hey, man, we're heading into November. And you go, oh,
damn.
Well, what are we going to do now? I said I was going to do this. And then you just do it, and either you get beat up or you win or whatever. But when you're done, you go, I'm glad I did it. Just 100%. Sort of plan that thing in advance.
Yeah, and this is really, you know, the plant medicine work that I do, that's really a fist fight for your emotions, for your ego, for your consciousness, right? You know, you go in. The very first time I did ayahuasca, the vision that I had was that I had spiders crawling in my eyes and exploding out of my brain. Eels were eating my insides. I was sliding down a vine of thorns naked, and it was just ripping up my balls.
Wow.
And then, that, as if that wasn't enough, it was like, oh, okay, by the way, you have cancer and you're going to die, right? Like, that was like the first 2 hours of this whole experience until finally I was like, all right, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And at the moment I released that fear of death, it was like one of the warmest feelings I've ever felt. Like, I purged a deep-seated fear where, yeah, I don't want to die. I don't want all those things to happen. But if it was to happen, all right, so what? I died. You know, and that one gift from that very first lesson is something that I've taken along the way, because these fears, these deep ones, these big ones, these fear of death, where do you get to practice that? Like, there's no basketball practice that allows you to practice the fear of death unless you're actually doing something that's near deadly, right? But this is a way to just simulate that in the mind, and that's why they call ayahuasca the vine of the soul or the vine of death, because it tends to put you in confrontation with these deep fears and allow you to go through it in a safe environment where you're going to come out of that physically unharmed. And if psychically, if you surrender and make the right choices to overcome your fear, then you're going to have a huge leg up. So it's a way for me to put myself in the fire and gain the lessons of that stress, especially now that I'm out of sports.
How many times have you done it?
17 times.
And the first time, obviously, that's the unknown. There's more fear involved with it, and that's more to purge. But the 10th time, what was that like?
You know, what's wild is every time is different. Sometimes it's like a joyride. Sometimes it's the most beautiful visions you've ever seen, and you feel so impossibly good that it recalibrates your whole idea about what feeling good could be. Like, if you took the moment of orgasm and you extended it and into 30 minutes and pushed it all through every cell of your body, like, sometimes it feels like that. And then sometimes it's gotten even darker than that first one. You know, I had an experience, it was about the 10th time, where ayahuasca took me down this path where it was like, you know what? Not only you're going to die, it's that you never mattered. It's like, mm-hmm. you're nothing. You're the gum on nothing's shoe. You're water borrowed from the ocean and the ocean forgot. You're completely worthless. And so I had to surrender. Like, even in my death, I had some idea like, well, I lived well. I'll leave a legacy. Some people will remember me. I was like, nah, bitch, you're nothing. Right? So it like pushed me to even surrender another deeper fear, not only dying, but not having ever mattered, not having had anyone ever care. And then surrendering right. that fear was like another level. And it always seems like there's just one more level of fear that you're able to overcome. But there is a progression. Like, I see myself getting to deeper layers. And I honestly don't know how far that goes.
What is the feeling like then, let's say, the following week? I'm not talking about hangover. I'm talking about the emotional feeling. Then as you head back to the United States, is there a feeling of being sort of cleansed? Has the Etch-a-Sketch been shaken and there's nothing left on it? Do you look at things through a new lens?
It feels like you came in with a giant backpack, and your backpack is all of these fears, all of these expectations, these attachments, these things that you think about yourself that are essential, that you're afraid of and you're protecting and you're worried about. And then when you go through this experience, oftentimes it feels like you just took that backpack off and all you are is awareness in a human body. You know, that's, and it gets really, really simple and really, really pleasurable. Like, these things that stress us out, you know, these things that we think are life and death, our business, our possessions, all of these things, they become less important. They become fun. They become like moving the chess pieces around, playing a game that you enjoy rather than some life or death high stakes thing that we think it is.
Yeah. It's weird. I feel like the country and maybe the world is going into these two groups. And I always say, like, when people say about, oh, the growth of the UFC is so incredible in the last 5-10 years. And I go, as we turn into bigger pussies, this sport, there's no reason why. The reason why this sport's getting bigger is because we're getting bigger and we're getting softer. And we need to watch. Sure. We have this primal thing in us, but we're sitting in air conditioning getting fat. And so we'll watch these guys with the blood pouring from them. I don't think it would have worked as well 30, 40 years ago. It's sort of like, if you ever talk to Dominatrix, I always talk to him. Whenever I talk to Dominatrix, I'll go, you don't have any Mexican clients, do you? And they go, nope. And I go, you don't have any black clients, do you? And they go, I do not. And then I go, what do you have? You have fat, white, rich guys. Yes, I do. And I go, how come? Because black people are getting the shit kicked out of them. And that's called Monday. That's called a day at work. Yeah. And so are the Mexicans. They don't need to have Mistress Dominatrix kick the shit out
of them. It's so rare for the white guy, it becomes a fetish. Right?
It becomes a fetish. No, yeah. And I always talk to him and I go, that guy runs 250 people, right? That's right. He bosses around 250 people all day. And on Saturday, he wants to be bossed around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the black guy and the Mexican guy want to rub and tuck because they've had the shit kicked out of them. They were getting bossed around by the white guy all day. And on Saturday, they want to rub and tug. And I feel that way. It's like the softer we get, the more extreme sports, small percentage of people are going to participate, but octagon, combat sports, extreme sports. And I'm feeling this way sort of like emotionally. I feel like the lion's share of the people in this country are just drones that are going about their work, cheering for their sports team, eating their processed food. And then there's this small group of people that just want more. Yeah. And everything. And now, like, they want to focus on their brain. They want to focus on their body. They want to focus on the best. Like,
I think it's a very simple choice. And that choice is to decide whether to use resistance as assistance or whether to run away from all resistance. Like, once you learn that mechanism that the body responds to stress with positive results, then you can look out at these stressful situations. Because in hindsight, we look back at some of the hard shit that happened and we're like, in hindsight, yeah, I'm really grateful for that. That made me who I am. But with foresight, when we're looking forward and we're mm-hmm. saying, oh, look at these things happening, we don't look with that same wisdom of hindsight. We look with fear and, oh, let's avoid these stressful stressful situations at all costs. Let's make it as comfortable as possible. Well, if you do that, you're never going to grow. And I think it's that simple choice of, like, once you learn that putting yourself in stressful situations causes the adaptations that make you better, like tempering the steel of your spirit, like the old Japanese sword makers that would thrust steel in a fire until it was molten hot and then hammer it and then fold it again and thrust it in. When you learn that that's what makes your own steel stronger, then you become addicted to that pursuit, because that's what's going to bring you the greatest happiness and the greatest success is going leaning into that. And I agree with you. I think there's a bifurcation. I think there's people who are still on that avoidance, and then there's people who are like, all right, I get it. I get this game. I get how human beings are supposed to adapt.
Yeah, it's a sort of simple approach, but it involves you being a little bit tough on yourself. But I realized where the separation is, and I believe I'll speak for you, and then you speak for you. I don't look at a correction or a suggestion, or even a being coached up, as anything negative. And so many people I know have a negative knee-jerk reaction to coached up. And I was sitting in my kitchen last night, and I'm sitting there with my wife and my nanny. I say my nanny, but my kid's nanny, but now I got her on my shit, too. So, and she said, I came in, and the iron skillet that you're making scrambled eggs in was in the sink with water in it. And now you're not supposed to do that because it gets rusty. You don't leave it on the cooktop. Don't, or hit it, wipe it with a paper towel and some oil or something, but don't throw it in the sink. And then she looked and said, who threw it in the sink? And I said, well, you know, I didn't. And you want to know why? And she said, why? And I said, because we talked about it one time.
Yeah.
And it's never gone in the sink again. And then my wife said, I put it in the sink, but I didn't really submerge it. And I said, yeah, but even with a cup of water in it, it's still going to rust. And she said, I didn't submerge it. And I said, just don't put it near the sink. And she said, well, it was in there, but it really didn't have any water in it. And I said, this is not a critique. And it's not a put down, but it shouldn't feel like a put down. It shouldn't feel like a critique. It didn't feel like a critique to me when my nanny told me I was doing this wrong and not to do this. It felt like a suggestion to me, and it felt like a tip. And my wife at a certain point said, all right, I got it, which is good. But I want everyone to have all these things to not feel like a critique or a put down or criticism. Feel like what it is. It's a tip.
Yeah. It comes from this idea that we think that we're supposed to be perfect, that we think that we're supposed to know everything and do everything right, and we hold ourselves and we judge ourselves accordingly. So anytime we fall short of perfection, we beat ourselves up. Oh, I should have known that. I shouldn't have put that in the sink. And so you have this negative internal response where your own self-judge starts to, you know, really criticize yourself and beat yourself up because you're holding yourself to a standard of perfection. Well, guess what? Nobody's fucking perfect. We all have shit we don't know. We all have things that we're going to screw up. And when you really adopt that and you ditch this idea that you're going to be perfect, then it's like, oh, cool, I learned something. Or like, oh, great, you know, more knowledge now. And you just accept it easier without that resistance because you're not worried about the judge going to kick your ass for being wrong.
Right. And the kind of notion of you saying, well, here's how I do it is a bad notion. Mm-hmm. I've always told everyone I am a pretty good carpenter, and I never read a book on carpentry. I simply listened to guys who knew more than me on the job site tell me. Carpentry is one big food chain of 38-year-old dude telling 22-year-old dude, hey, fuckwad, you're doing it wrong. Give me that. You know what the fuck you're doing. Give me that. Let me show you how to do this. That's all it is.
Yeah.
It's all it is. And then the 22-year-old kid has to go, okay, from this day forth, I will do it that way.
Yep.
And it's just one big, if you're going to cut some finished plywood and you want a nice edge, put a straight edge on it, like a level, take a utility knife and score it first. And then it won't pop up on you when you're running your blade over it. And then you just go, okay,
Yeah, it's a classic apprenticeship model where you really have to learn from the masters before you can deviate and create your own little style.
But like, everybody be in that mode. Yeah. And what I would suggest doing things like go to a driving school, like a real driving school. You know, go to Bondurant or something for like 2 days or 3 days. And get used to the guy who's your instructor who'll be sitting in the passenger seat. When you're turning into the corner, he'll reach over and grab the steering wheel and go, apex, apex, start turning for you and start pushing your leg more, 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 less, less, back, back, back. And just let him, just let it go and just come out and be a better driver. And then just then approach that in life. Do everything that way. Now, look. Don't have homeless people tell you to sleep with a bag over your head until you die. But when the guy's the instructor over at Bondurant, listen to him.
Yeah. Well,
but, and you get to be the judge and jury of what is a good idea. Later on, when I had my little glass cream that I was putting in my coffee, I was sort of dumping it out. And the bottles are like thick glass, and they you get like a buck for them when you return them. I don't care about the money. I just care about the waste. Mm-hmm. So Olga, the nanny, has the little cream container, and she brings it back to the Sprouts and gets the new one, gets the buck, whatever it is. She told me about 3 weeks ago when I was kind of dumping it, and I'd take it and have this thick cream in it. I'd go rinse it out in the sink and stuff. She said, take the hot coffee, pour a little bit of it in there, shake it up. Get every ounce of cream out of there and then dump it back into the mug. And I was like, you're right. That's a great idea. And I'll never do it another way.
Yeah.
It'll never be the old way.
Yeah.
I'll take tips from anybody in broken English. I'll take those tips if I think it's going to help me.
You see it in all kinds of different traditions too. You see it in academia, even like somebody will hold on to their idea because maybe they're tenured because they had this theory that they developed, and this theory was the shit for a while, and that's what gave them their identity. They were the professor, they were the academic who came up with this thing. And well, theories change all the time. New information comes out, new data becomes available, but you'll see them, and it's sad. They'll be hanging on and clinging to their old theory, even in the face of wildly different truth. Like the people who right now are opposing marijuana legalization, like you got no outs. It's like when you're watching the TV and you're watching those people play poker, and they're like, he's drawing dead right now, and you got a little 0% on your thing. Like those are the people who continue to want to ban marijuana. Like the data's in, you're out of reasons, right? But they'll still cling to it because it's emotional, and it's this inflexibility of the mind that's really challenging, and something as a nation we got to get over.
I agree. And you know, this notion of couple things. It reminds me, like Mark Garagus comes in here, attorney Mark Garagus, and we go nuts over these prosecutors and these DAs who find out very early on in the trial that the Duke Lacrosse guys were at the ATM instead of in the bathroom of the frat house when the alleged rape went down. And they have pictures and film of the guy at the ATM at 12:07. And she's saying, I got raped in the bathroom at 12:07, and this guy's at ATM across town. And when at that point, you have to go, we're dropping it. Mm-hmm. I was wrong. We're going the wrong direction. You don't double down at that point. But that's how a lot of people are wired. And I got no problem with a DA who goes, look, we got information. We thought it was correct. It turns out it wasn't. We're taking our foot off the accelerator. We're going to focus on real criminals or whatever it is. That's fine. I'm fine with that guy. I'm fine with the politician who says, I was against gay marriage because I thought it was weird, or I am Christian, or whatever. And it just seemed nobody was for gay marriage. I wasn't for gay marriage. It's like you've told me about gay marriage in 1999. I would have went, oh, well, that's weird. No, you can't do that. And now it's like, great, fine. I'm not clinging to whatever that was. I don't know what we want to call it. I just changed my mind.
I see it with CEOs and entrepreneurs so often. Like the ceiling is usually they get more inflexible and they become resistant to new ideas. Like at some point, the executives of Blockbuster Video were like, nah, nah, video. We're sticking with it. We're doubling down on videos, right? 'Cause, and they had people coming to them and be like, videos are gone. They're dead. It's all going to be digital. We got to change our model. And like, mm-mm. This is, we built this business with our bare hands.
I'm laughing because that's a macro. I'll give you a micro, which cracks me up. My own family, they were all horrible losers. They're all losers because they basically stuck to a losing game plan their entire fucking life. And now they're heading for the grave with their losing playbook. Yeah. My grandmother, my grandfather, not blood related, but my step grandfather, the only grandfather I ever knew, was nominated for writing a movie in the, for an Academy Award in like 1947 or something. And so thus they were in the Academy. And the only good part about being in the Academy is you would get screeners. Mm-hmm. And you'd get the freebie screeners. Back when that was a big deal to get a movie and to be able to watch it at home. And they would get VHS cassettes. And VHS cassettes would show up at my grandma's house. And eventually after, you know, there'd be 12, 18, 20 show up every year. So eventually, after 20 years, she had like hundreds of these tapes. And they were like trying to build makeshift pine shelves and stuff. They're like, where are we going to put them all?
Right.
And also, she liked it because she was getting older. And you know how it is. People stop visiting and stuff like that. But we were like, hey, grandma, I was thinking about coming by and paying a visit and just saying hi. Okay. Did you get Color Money in yet? Is that? Yeah, I have it. Okay. Yeah, just no. But anyway, I'll just come by and say hi. Like, people start like hanging out. It'd sure. be like 20 minutes ago. Like, you know, oh, I got to get back to work. Oh, mind if I grab Color Money? Is that, do we have that? And she didn't realize it was like an attraction. Like, uh-huh. And she liked it. But at a certain point, circa 1997, it wasn't that long ago. They said they had a box to check. Would you like, I'm getting a note from Gary. Yeah, The Mole People, my grandfather wrote, it was 1956, but it was nominated for a film. It wasn't nominated for Academy Award for The Mole People, I don't think. So that's the number I was looking for, but thanks. So at some point, they gave a thing, and it had a box, and it said, would you like a DVD? Instead of this VHS.
Yeah.
And I said, Grandma, check that box. And she said, I got a VHS player. And I said, I will buy you a DVD player. I will put the DVD player in your house. And not only will we save a ton of space, because these things are like wafer thin according to your big Kleenex box they're sending over, but your stuff's going to degrade over years and blah, blah, blah. And there's just so much more valuable. And I think she was kind of thinking like, oh, but wait a minute. Some of the people that want to borrow them don't have DVD players, so they won't be coming around. But either way, I just said to her, do the DVD. Trust me. That's where this is heading. And I will get you a DVD player, and I will set it up in your house. And she's like, all right. And then like I saw her a week later. I was like, DVD? And she's like, nah, I just went VHS. I was like, all right. Great. Yeah. That's a great way to go through life. And now we still have piles and piles and piles of those degrading VHS tapes that we don't.
Nobody has a player.
We're like Tom Hanks on that island. We'll make an axe out of a roller skate with it.
Yeah, it's people cling to this consistency, this piece that no longer serves them for so long. It's really wild, and they do it. You know, obviously in health and fitness, you see it in diet all the time.
Yeah,
you know, like all of the nutrition information has reversed its position on dietary fat. I mean, not the fried stuff and French fries, but good, healthy, saturated fats. Like, that is a key to actually maintaining, you know, ideal weight management, to losing weight. If you're not eating fat, you're probably going to be overweight. But instead, this idea that sugar and vegetable oils were going to be better, it's still so ingrained in people that it's, even though there's like a meta-analysis of hundreds of thousands of people in 21 different clinical trials, all showing that fat is not correlated to heart disease, they still cling to this old information. And you can put the data in front of them, say, look, here's the data, all the data. And they'll still go back and they'll still, I got to get my lean protein and my egg whites and my non-fat yogurt. And I'm like, why?
Look, I'm with you, had Vinny Tortorich in here, and he's talking about it. And the second he said, you know, have some bacon and eggs, I was like, all right, I'm down with that.
Yeah.
And I'm off the oatmeal and onto the bacon and eggs because the expert guy told me. It's a weird thing. Like, I've gotten into this at my own house where I've said, like, hey, man, the pancakes and the syrup, that's bad. Hard-boiled egg and an apple, much better. It's like, hey, they want a hot, hearty breakfast. And it's like, that's not a hot – I mean, it's hot. And I don't know if you could argue about the hearty part, but it's not good. Now, to be fair, my kids won't eat an apple and a hard-boiled egg. But there's a kind of a mindset, which is almost sort of it's almost kind of like goes back to some sort of native tribesman or something where it's like hot, hearty versus the austere hard-boiled egg and the green apple. But that's so much better for the kids. But there's it's my sort of gun in the swimming pool, which is – every mom I know is scared of a house with a gun in it, but they have no problem about a house with a swimming pool in it. And statistically, the kid's going to die in the pool before the kid gets hold of the gun. Statistically, it's overwhelming.
Yeah, it's the emotions. The emotions are driving the logic rather than the logic driving the emotions. I think we think that, oh, this thought is making me feel this emotion. No. This emotion is then causing you to justify that emotion with your thoughts.
That's a very eloquent way of putting it. And it's, again, my wife would not let my son or daughter get on a motorcycle, but she'd be more than happy to put him on a horse, which is fine with me. But if the horse is statistically more dangerous than the motorcycle, then in my world, they get to ride both or neither.
Right.
But that's purely based on statistics and not emotion. Although the reason she's a better parent than I am is the emotion.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, because they're more emotionally adept.
Right. So let's not purge all of it.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's just that it's part of how our brain works. Our brain takes symbols and takes thoughts, and then it imprints those thoughts with the emotion. And it's really like the basis of PTSD, right? PTSD is when you have a memory of a certain thing, and that memory is imprinted with the emotional state that you felt surrounding it. So that when you access that memory, you re-access that emotional state, and that creates the PTSD, right? So everything that we do when we encode our emotion, when we bind our emotion to that thought, and that could happen in a million different ways. It could happen something you heard from somebody else. It could happen from direct experience. Maybe in your case, it was a news piece that came out or a visual of somebody who crashed on a motorcycle, and it binds that thought, that idea with this fear that you actually felt. Then every time you access that, you're going to re-access those emotions because that's just how the brain processes that information. And I think becoming aware of that and being like, all right, what's the actual truth here and what's the emotion that's coming across? Because if you've been overweight and you've been trying to cut out all fat in your diet, any fat you see is going to cause that, this is going to make me fat, and that's going to be this negative emotion that it's bound with. So even when you get new information, you're still going to feel that emotion about these foods that you don't really know what to do with, so you just stay away from them.
Well, you know, the biggest problem with the word fat's got the word fat in it, and we're so freaked out over – I mean, the point is you don't want to be fat, so you eat fat? Try and explain that to an alien. You know what I mean? That's kind of right. Where we're locked off at. And, you know, I feel the same way about work. Like people, they physically don't like the word work, and then they're going to work. So, like, we got to remove the word work from work and fat from fat.
I agree.
And diet from diet. Because they don't want to be on a diet. But no, this is your diet. This is what your food is comprised of, or your eating is comprised of. But it's got the word diet and fat. We're so easily manipulated, I believe, or triggered, you know, emotionally.
Yeah, words are symbols themselves, and then we build all of these things around these symbols. And when it's the same word for two different symbols, like dietary cholesterol, like the stuff you find in egg yolks, is completely different than what we're referring to when we say we have high cholesterol. Like what we're talking about when we say high cholesterol are these lipoproteins, HDL and LDL, which are actually the carriers for cholesterol. Cholesterol is unequivocally healthy. Like we need it. It's in every single cell. It's something that forms the basis of all of our hormones. If we don't have enough, we won't have enough testosterone. Our whole body will start to go out of whack. It's correlated to depression, suicide, not having enough cholesterol is terrible. But because what we're talking about is we're worried about these lipoproteins, because we call that cholesterol. And then there's also cholesterol in the egg yolk. we correlate the same things and agree it's absolutely a problem with our language. When we make two different, vastly different symbols, you know, have the same word, we're really like short-circuiting some aspect of our brain until you really unpack it.
Well, there's two things that I'm thinking of. One is, people, please, I like, once again, if you want to, you know, when I'd been, I hadn't been religious about it, but it's like, hey, if I had toast, it'd be dry toast because I was trying to eat healthy. I wasn't putting butter on it, you know, and maybe I'd have an egg white omelet or something like that because I'm trying to be healthy, you know. And then Vinny Tortorich came in here and he sat there and he said, don't do that. And I went, fine. And that's the last time I thought about it. I didn't find myself straying back to my old ways. Now, look, I get addiction. You know, hey, maybe you drank a little too much last weekend. You probably shouldn't be drinking. It's 4th of July weekend. What's wrong with a beer? Like, I get that. That's being a human. But when the expert guy says, go ahead and put that butter on your toast, then go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Or just eat the butter and leave the toast. Then go ahead and do it. I mean, Vinny was like, put a pat of butter in your coffee in the morning. I was like, done and done. Like,
I'm in. Yeah.
Now, if you think about it, in your past life, that was a punchline to a joke. That's like Jeff Ross saying, Ralphie May is so fat, he puts butter in his coffee. But now I got the expert over there who runs the super marathons telling me to do it. And I go, done, done and done. And everybody with everything. Now, again, I would put a little warning around politicians and what they have to say. And keep in mind where you're getting some of your information, CNN, Fox, whatever, they got their own agenda.
Sure.
But when the guy with no agenda, who's an expert, tells you to do something, then by all means, listen up. And I would tell people all the time, if I go to a race and I go to, I was just talking to somebody about this where I said, I ended up being really fast at Willow Springs, and I'm not good at the track, and I'm in a totally different car, and I have no real reason to be fast there other than coming up to the race, I watched a video. And the video, you just Google in best line at Willow Springs, and there'll be some dude, and he has his in-car camera, and he's got his 911 souped up, and he drives the track. And he stops it and goes, it's a late apex, or look for this, or look, when you go to the top, to the horseshoe, it'll say Budweiser on the building, you should be going straight at the B, and then you turn. They're weird videos. Yeah. Admittedly, they're weird, but you just watch them, and you watch them, and you watch them, and then when you get on the track, you do what that guy told you to do. And I was telling this to somebody the other day, and he said, yeah, but what if that guy's a hack? And I said, well, first off, you would know it. Like, first off, he's not turning really fast lap times if he's doing everything wrong. He'd be going slow. So you can tell he's fast by watching. But number two, if something seems insane, don't do it. But if it all, when it's right, it kind of makes sense. I have this feeling that we sort of, even if we don't know what's going on, we do know the truth at some level. And I have enough experience to understand if he's telling me to do something that seemed, you know, very, very off, very wrong. But just watch your videos and then just do what that guy did, or do it as close as you can do it to that guy, because that guy's been around the track 5,000 times and he's fast.
Having that truth detection skill, like to be able, it's like a musician who knows when an instrument's in tune and out of tune. You
right.
know, like, and we all have that with truth to a certain degree if we actually pay attention. This ability to say, what he's saying, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's like an instrument out of tune. Something is off. Something just doesn't sound in harmony.
Right.
And I think we all have that, but we override it and we doubt it and we allow, you know, again, emotional-based decisions or other things to cloud our perception, this ideas of who he is. But really tapping into that, it's incredibly valuable, because then you'll be able to hear something once and say, oh, that sounds like harmony, and investigate it, you know, back it up with as much evidence as you need to. But that ability to hear something, see something, read something, and then apply your own kind of truth analysis to it and get it right, that just allows you to move so much quicker. You know, your speed increases dramatically.
Well, I always sort of tell everybody to have their antenna or their satellite dish always recalibrated every day. Just always a little turn this way and a little nudge that way. Just always, so you're always, it's not you do it once and walk away. It's every day. Make sure you're completely tuned in And it was funny because just this morning, I was one of my loser buddies from high school, Ray, was at my house doing some work with involving floating a shower pan. I won't get too specific, but it was funny. I just always what I do is I just judge everything all the time, but it's not judge. Again, judge, not a negative thing. We turn it like, don't judge me. Yeah. Why not? Maybe I think you're really hot. Maybe right. I think you're really smart.
And try not to judge. Good luck with that.
Yeah, Trey, yeah. Good luck. Right. So I'm just walking around with my head on a swivel, doing my judging, calculating what everyone's history is and trying to figure out what their future is going to be. And at some point, I walk in on my buddy Ray, and he's down on his knees pouring some Type S mortar and working the shower pan or whatever. And he's on what appears to be a black foam rubber pad. And I just immediately paused and I went, Ray's not the kind of guy. Ray's the kind of guy who would just be on his knees on the concrete for 100 years and never get one of these pads. Or he'd be a kind of guy who would pull up a milk crate or something that you had and sit on it. But he would never go out, purchase his own pad, and then roll it out onto a concrete floor. And then I stopped and I went, well, why wouldn't he? I mean, he does this for a living. He's down on his knees all day working on concrete. Yeah. Why not have a pad, like a gardening pad, so you didn't kill your knees? And I thought, but that's just not like him. And then, so I stopped and I said, where'd you get the pad? And he said, like, huh? And I said, where'd you get the pad? And he said, oh, that's your doormat. I just grabbed it and turned it upside down. And I said, we're back. Now we're back. We're back in the land. Now I know.
Yeah.
It was bothering me that you were doing something not good or bad, just off of your schedule.
Yeah, that the tune. The tune was a little out of tune.
I walked into my bathroom and I was like, something's a little pitchy, dog. And then I looked. And then I figured it out. Now, I'm not really trying to be pejorative about it. I'm just, it was out of tune for his instrument.
Yeah.
And once I found out it was my welcome mat from the front door that was turned over and I was looking at the rubberized underside of it and that the welcome part was getting covered with concrete, then I was back.
Yeah. Well, you got to be careful. Sometimes there'll be these little jingles that someone will play, these aphorisms, these things that people say that sound so sweet and so good that you adopt them. Like there's this thing, you know, that says, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you get that stuck in your head, then you're pretty much always going to be disappointed because I fucking love what I do and I work. You know, like you have to, like that whole line is complete bullshit. I couldn't be happier with my job, but it's still sometimes just a grind.
It's a great point. Yeah. It drives me nuts when I hear like the pro athlete, hey, when you stop having fun out there, it's time to hang up the cleats. It's like, it's time to walk away from $31 million a year because you stopped having fun.
Yeah.
You've been playing this game for 20 years. You got a bunch of injuries. You know, it's baseball season, 162 games. You're having fun in Milwaukee in July. No one else, no roofer says, hey, man, you stop hanging those shingles, stops being a good time. It's time to hang it up. Like, no, it's not. It's called a job.
Yeah.
It's not going to be fun every day. And I love what I do, but hey, I'm doing, you know, I'll do 7 podcasts in one day. That's work. You're exactly right. I wish we'd stop that. I don't even know where that comes from.
And it just sets us up for being constantly disappointed because it's saying, oh, something that other people doing makes their life, you know, amazing and fun and everything's going to be, would be good if I was like that. But my life sucks because I actually have to work. Right. And it's just this way that we just torture ourselves. It's not true.
The whole thing. I mean, even as you distill it down to like, hey, man, follow your own truth and all that kind of stuff. I don't like any of that stuff. I'm not sure what it means. Like I hear people say, I got to be true to myself, and I don't know what the fuck that means.
Yeah, who is yourself?
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yourself is a different fucking person every day you wake up. When you're angry, when you have this meal, when you have that meal. When you take a dump, you're literally losing billions of cells that are part of yourself that are producing neurotransmitters that are going to change the way you think. What is your fucking self? It's different all the time.
Thank you. You'd make a great groundling instructor. Because I hear people make those proclamations. I don't know what they mean.
Yeah.
I don't, even when people talk about pride, I don't really know what it means. I mean, I want to go out and kick ass every day, but I don't have any pride, and I don't.
It's because you're not gay.
I'm not true to myself. If I was gay, I could get some pride.
You got lots of pride.
And be true to myself. I just feel like I don't like those. I don't like those proclamations, and the reason it's I don't like. My poor assistant one day fucked something up and said to me, "Hey, I tried my best." And I was like, "Don't ever say that. Don't ever say that." I had a weird conversation with Gary across the glass where there was some news story, and it was a semi-popular news story. And I said, "Hey, tell me about this news story." And he said, "I don't know what you're talking about, and I'm not familiar with it." And I said, "Well, you're the producer. You should be familiar with it." And he said, "Sorry, I'm a little out of the loop." And I said, "Don't say out of the loop, because that would suggest that somebody went in another room, shut the door, and had a conversation you weren't privy to. This is on the internet. Right. You can find this." And I think Gary doesn't like it. He doesn't like it initially. But you know what?
When I thought about it, you were right.
But let me say this, Gary. Whether it's "I tried my best," that was Matt Fondelier, in which case I coined the phrase, "Don't do your best, do my best," because your best's not working. Gary used to be much more, he doesn't feel it or may not know it. You're much more reticent. You're standoffish. You'd push back. Now you go, "Right, I shouldn't have phrased it that way, and it'll help for the next endeavor."
I thought about it a little bit, and I think what I should have said was out of touch. I didn't mean to imply someone. I had missed it, and I was readily aware of that. I just used the wrong verbiage.
No, I mean, yes and no, because we have built, everybody has this sort of mechanism, which is a way to kind of protect themselves from criticism, or should have known this, or should have done that. So there's literally, some people have, you know, if you say to a kid, "Hey, you're fat," they'll go, "You're fat." Like that just come flying out of their mouth.
Right.
They'd say to Bill Nye, the science guy.
Yeah.
They just do it. That's what my kids do. You go, "You do this." They go, "You do this." Uh-huh. That's it. So as adults, you try to get a little bit to wean that out of you, but it's still a little bit of still in you. And when somebody says, "You should have been on top of this. You should have known about this thing that you never heard of." If you say, "I was out of the loop," it's a subtle way of letting yourself off the hook. You may say it's semantics, but it's an emotional thing that says, "Well, I was kept away from it," versus "I missed it." And I would suggest, just in general, that type of verbiage adds up to a sort of overall gestalt of your life of not having responsibility. Just get into the habit of going, "Should have known, that one's on me," or my favorite, "Not going to happen again."
Yeah.
And once you start building that in, instead of this thing, we do all this affirmation bullshit where it's like, you got to love yourself. You got to look in the mirror and talk about how much you love yourself. You got to understand no one else was created like you. You have to visualize loving yourself. Knock it off. Beat yourself up a little bit and see if you get somewhere. I don't think the people that are visualizing loving themselves are doing anything.
You know, there's one really empowering thing that you can say to yourself, and it's contraindicated to what we're trying to do all the time, and that's to say, "It's all my fault." Like, that's probably the most powerful thing you can say. No matter what happens, no matter what bad shit happened, if you're like, "No, yeah, it's my fault. You know, it's my bad." Because then at that point, when, you know, you have the opportunity to change it. You have the opportunity to look and say, "Okay,
yeah,
I blew it, and now I can do something about it." And guess what? When you do something about it, then you can say it's all my fault too. You
know,
when you do something good, that same phrase applies, and you'll actually feel it. You'll actually feel it in your bones, like, "Yeah, I did this. I took the fall when it was bad, and I took the fall when it was good."
I would say responsibility. If fault is a little bit tough,
yeah, sure.
People don't like saying "my fault," but it's just my responsibility.
Jocko Willink, who's a former guest of this show, has an amazing video that's gone viral online where he just basically says "good" to whatever happens, whether it's good or bad, and it's the very much the point you're making, Aubrey. It's a great for those who want to check that out.
I haven't caught Jocko. I'm a little out of the loop on the Jocko stuff, but blame Matt. He should have shown me that. No, it's right. Just imbibe it, and then it goes down. It's very bitter at the beginning with this sort of internalization, this part where you go like, because your first knee-jerk reaction is, not my fault, you're fat too, how could I have known, nobody could have, you know. I can't tell you all the people that just, they say weird, their answers are the wrong answers, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, I got a guy, another guy named Gary, works at the other shop, and I've told him 1,000 times, if you're going to Home Depot, you need to tell me, because I got shit I want from Home Depot. I don't want you to go to Home Depot and then come back, and then I go, I wanted two things, 100% clear caulk, siliconized caulk, and he'll go, I didn't get it. I say, stop and tell me. But they give answers, and the answers are weird. Like, so he went to Home Depot the other morning and came back, and I said to him once again, hey, Gary, remember that conversation we had about you going to Home Depot and not contacting me? And he went, I thought you knew. It's like, I know it felt good to answer it that way at the moment, sure. But you went to Home Depot at 8 a.m. in Glendale, and I'm in La Cañada drinking coffee in my bathrobe. How is it I would know? I just get a spidey senses tingling. Like, how would I know? And then he stopped, and he said, I thought Rob knew, and Rob would tell you. And then Rob was standing there, and he said, I didn't know about this. And I said, Gary, I'd like this to not happen anymore. And so because I'd like it to stop happening, I'm not interested in shaming you, although we're going down a road now yeah. where we're going to end up shaming you. But I don't want to go down that road. I want you to not go to Home Depot without alerting me. You have a phone, do you not? Yes. Rob has a phone. Yes. Do you have his phone number? Yes. Can you call Rob when you're going to Home Depot and explain to him you're going and have this never happen again? Now, it will happen again, and the reason it'll happen again is because his first answer wasn't, sorry, never going to happen again. Mm-hmm. His first answer was, I thought you knew. I'm amazed at the answers that people provide.
Yeah, they're not willing to stand in the fire of that being wrong or making a mistake, you know?
So much so that they can say nonsensical, they can blurt out right. nonsensical things, which is, I thought you knew. How would I possibly know you're going to Home Depot on Tuesday morning at 8?
You know,
and even if it's a 92% chance that I knew, how about verifying?
Yeah. You know, one thing that I read from Eckhart Tolle, who's, you know, I think really wise when it comes to certain things, is he talks about when you take criticism, even if it's unfounded, like the natural response, especially if it's unfounded, you know, is to get angry. Like, well, fuck this guy. Look at you fucking talking to me from your mom's basement. Like, right. What do you know, right? But his recommendation is just to stop for a minute and just receive the full force of that criticism. Just take it in and say, all right, how does that feel? You know, before responding outwardly to anything. So you practice and pattern this ability to stay in the fire under criticism or under critique, you know, and even in a case where you didn't do anything wrong, just accept it and then be okay with that. And then you can shed it after that, but use that as a tool to teach you. Use that as a way to practice standing in the fire where someone's saying that you are a piece of shit, you know, which is what we're saying to ourselves in our mind, which is the reason why we're coming up with all these excuses. Like, practice just standing in the fire and then saying, all right, well, you're wrong, but, you know, thanks for that, because that helped me practice actually, you know, feeling those feelings that I've been running away from for so long.
Or you're 89% wrong, but
yeah,
there's
a
11%
totally.
That I'd like to take and use.
Totally.
I've said it a million times. Whenever I do a project, a house, a remod, and I do tons of that stuff, I take as many people as I can, including my Guatemalan nanny, and I walk them through it. And I go, tell me what are your ideas? What do you think? Yeah. And they go, I put the bed over here and the bathroom over there. And I go, why would you do that? And they go, I think the bed. And then sometimes I go, you're exactly right. That's a good idea. Or sometimes I go, I think the bed should go against this wall. And then they'll go, oh, yeah, you're right. Makes more sense to put the bed against this wall. Run a bunch of eyeballs through it. You don't have to agree. When I walk people through these projects, I don't think in advance, all right, I'm going to agree with this person or I'm going to disagree with this person. I'm completely neutral. If they have an idea that's good, I'm doing it. If they have an idea that's not good, I'm not doing it. I get to live in the house. That's the part that I try to explain to people all the time. When they go, why do you want somebody else coming in here and laying out your... It's because it's your house. You get to live in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You think Jimmy writes all those jokes for the Oscars? No, there's fucking 16 guys in a room. Guess who gets all the credit? Jimmy does.
Yeah.
Good. Good for him. That's why he should use my joke if it's a 7.5 versus his joke if it's a 7.
Yeah.
Because he's going to get all the benefit from it. Not sure why more people don't focus on that.
Yeah, they're hanging on to too much. You know, too many ideas about themselves, too many things that they think that they have to defend. It's all good. You're you, and that's enough. You're you. You're living. Like, that's all that really matters. All of these ideas that you have about yourself, just let that shit go, and then you'll be way slicker, way faster. Like, life is really like a marathon. And if you're holding on to these backpacks of ideas and expectations and identity and ego and all this shit, you're just ladening yourself down, and you're going to have way less fun, and you're going to accomplish way less.
I feel like that's a very positive note to go out on. On it. Let's go there. On it. Two N's. I and a T. .com. All the great supplements and all the great equipment and the new jump rope coming out. Love that. You can check out the podcast, the Aubrey Marcus podcast on iTunes. Leave 5 stars. Give a nice
yeah,
rating.
Why not?
Yeah,
it's listen good. To some first, though.
Good juju, man. And you can sign up for the 16-week course, Go For Your Win, and that program, you can sign up at aubreymarcus.com. Did I got that right?
Yep.
And all the good stuff for a better life, man, at On It. Let's get on it, people. Let's separate ourselves a little,
yeah,
shall we? So, until next time, Adam Carolla for Aubrey Marcus. Say mahalo.
Congratulations. You're now a better person.
And by the way, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for you.
Download more wisdom and inspiration next week on Take a Knee. This is Corolla Digital.